this all over again this morning. We're going to do a giant do-over. Good morning and welcome to the September 26th, 2012 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, literary agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm joined for the full hour by Claire Watkins. Claire was born in Bishop, California in 1984. She was raised in the Mojave Desert, first in Tecopa, California, and then across the state line in Nevada. She has received fellowships from the writers' conferences at Sewanee and Breadloaf, and her stories and essays have appeared in Granta, One Story, The Paris Review, Plowshares, Glimmer Train, Best of the West 2011, Best of the Southwest 2013, and elsewhere. She is a graduate of the University of Nevada in Reno. She earned her MFA from The Ohio State University, where she was a presidential fellow. Claire is an assistant professor at Bucknell University and co-director of the Mojave School, a nonprofit creative writing workshop for teenagers in rural Nevada. Her collection of short stories, Battleborn, was released by Riverhead just last month. It is the subject of our chat this morning. Claire, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Sorry about all of our phone problems this morning.
No worries.
So I'm going to give you a chance to introduce the collection, talk about kind of the scope of the stories, how they gelled together, what you were thinking about when you assembled them into a collection, and just kind of take us inside Battleborn.
Sure. So I wrote Battleborn during my MFA when I was at Ohio State in Columbus, Ohio. When I moved to Columbus, it was the first time that I'd ever left the West. I'd lived in Nevada for my whole life, save for about 9 months spent in L.A. So I'd never left the West before, and I was really, really homesick for the desert, especially. And then this was sort of compounded by the fact that my mom died just before I left for Ohio. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the context that I was writing the stories in. So, you know, perhaps inevitably it became, these 10 stories became sort of a torch song to a place, but also it's kind of a book about loss and grief. You know, a lot of the characters are sort of trying to navigate empty spaces in their lives. And the stories themselves are set all over the state of Nevada and in California a bit too, as any Nevadan inevitably crosses over to that line sometimes, right?
Right.
So, and they span a wide range of time. There's a story set in the Gold Rush in 1849, and then other contemporary stories.
And tell me about the time frame over which you wrote these. It sounds like you wrote most of them during your MFA program, but were the 10 conceived of within a fairly compressed time frame of a couple of years? Had they been lingering stories that you know, you'd put in a drawer and come back to little nuggets of them and finish them up?
No, they were conceived of definitely while I was during a compressed time, during those 3 years while I was at Ohio State. I hadn't really written at all about the West when I lived there. It's only after I left that I started to kind of think about it and write about it. And then it was also going to Ohio State was the first time that I'd really met people from other parts of the country. It sounds a little bit, I always feel like a major country mouse saying that going to Ohio was sort of like a worldview shift for me, but it was, because I'd never really met anyone from New Jersey or Wisconsin or Florida, and those were the people who were around the table in my workshop, and they seemed really interested in stuff that I took for granted, like the desert and the details of how far away things are and how isolated people can be there and the trouble that you can get into, you know. So for me, I grew up taking it as a given that there are people, you know, getting lost in the desert and dying of thirst every single summer. But hearing my cohort say, "What? Tell me more about that," then I realized that how really, really rich the place was for stories. And the seeds for the stories themselves had definitely been floating around in my head for a long time. I mean, a lot of them are written after the rumors and the gossip I heard growing up in the Mojave Desert about you know, sort of horrific things or just otherwise like striking images that stayed with me. And so in a way, they came very quickly, very condensed together, and the idea for a book about Nevada came all in one chunk. But the ideas had been sort of simmering for many, many years.
Yeah. Now, I've heard that you start with setting, that you start with a place, and you chose mm-hmm. different towns around Nevada, the California-Nevada border, mm-hmm. And that became sort of the framework for which you started the stories, and, you know, what would happen in that town, and if you walked into a room, what's the worst thing that would happen if you were there, and what do those people mm-hmm. think and feel? So I'm curious about that, starting with place, as opposed to, you know, a lot of writers say they start with character, they start with a plot point, or, uh-huh. you know, something happened. And that really intrigued me, that the place was the place you started.
Yeah, I mean, that I realize now that it is a little bit quirky way to work, but it just sort of came naturally to me, probably because I was so homesick and so obsessed with things like landscape, and I've always been really interested in natural history, and I went to college thinking I might become a geologist. And so for me, place is, you know, I have to understand where a person is before I can figure out who they are. You know, I think one of my teachers in college said we are who we are because of where we are. Mm. And that makes a lot of sense to me. I can't really start in on character until I figure out, like, what does this person see when they wake up in the morning, you mm. know? And then I start to ask myself, well, what is this specific person? How are they going to internalize their landscape or their culture or the class? You know, like, when you start to think about it, to me, place is really just absolutely essential. And then plot sort of comes out of it too, right? Once I figure out who they are and where they are, then I start to ask myself, what kind of trouble might they get into, you know, emotionally or, you know, in the physical world too.
Right, right. I'm also curious about this notion of how much distance you have to have from a place that, you know, this notion that you were incredibly homesick when you were focusing on these stories. I know you've said in the aftermath of your mom's death, which wasn't that long ago, 5 years ago, that is too emotionally close for you to kind of tackle too much yet. There's some references in one of the stories, perhaps, to that. But this notion of how much distance you need from an event, either physical distance from the space you're writing about, emotional distance from the time period you're writing about, and your thoughts on kind of how much perspective you need to objectively write a short story.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's really been key, although I certainly wouldn't have said that, you know, when I got to Ohio State when I was 23 years old. So, you know, you don't have a lot of distance on anything when you're 23 years old. So I definitely wouldn't have said, oh, I can only write it. But I see now that the things I've written that are good are because I have had a little bit of distance, and the distance does a few things. It gives you kind of like fresh eyes on the place. It sort of defamiliarizes and denaturalizes, so you can start to see it as someone new to it, as a reader would, you know?
Right.
And it also can help to have something not be so emotionally raw, for me at least, you know? There's this little, like, sliver emotional moment when I think is really important to when you get your best writing done, and it's like you have the distance and the perspective to be able to approach the subject matter with craft and as a craft person, but it's also still matters to you. It's still relevant, you know, it's still like, so that you're writing close to the bone but not, you know, cutting off your own arm. And that's
right.
When stuff like being sentimental and nostalgic can really, and that's something that I was terrified about if I was writing just one long country song, you know?
Right, right. The other thing that's intriguing to me is sort of the, what your family owes you of their past. That question sort of came up for me. I think it's fairly well documented and talked about that your dad was involved in the Charlie Manson family clan, and your mom spent most of her life in recovery, and so AA played, you know, kind of a really big backdrop in your writing. It certainly comes out through here that people, you know, are happy to tell their gritty stories. Mm-hmm. That got me to thinking about what of our parents' past, and thinking about this as a mother myself, what of my past your children have a right to or your children have an access to, and then kind of how that informs their own thinking. And so I was curious about your experiences. I know your dad died when you were young, and your mom, you know, with her experiences in the recovery program. I just was interested in your thoughts on how their past informed you and how much of a right you felt to their history.
Well, I think, I mean, the question about how much of a right we have to, I understand to people's stories, I understand intellectually, but I have to admit it's not something that I ever worry much about. Emotionally or when I'm working, I feel like if I can make art that is true and fair and good, then that's all the right that I need. You know, that's mm-hmm. permission enough.
Right.
Maybe that's a bit really naive idea about it. But, I mean, this is something that has, of course, been, like, my family legacy has always been, like, inextricably tangled up with storytelling. Because my dad died when I was so young, and because of his involvement in the Manson family, I have all of these stories about him, all of this information, like be it clips from CNN or the book that he wrote himself or other people's stories. I mean, not a lot of people with a deceased parent have a big, you know, cache of information about him, and yet all that information, it really, I mean, well before I could have articulated this sentiment, I've realized like the limitations of storytelling and meaning making and narrative, because I look at something like a clip of my dad on CNN because I want to know, I guess, what kind of a man he was, and then what I should where I should go or what I might be like myself, and I of course I don't get that, and so I think that's kind of something that the book is not only interested in, like, our family legacies, and all legacies, too, like, sort of, like, macro-level historical legacies, but also the limitations of those. You know, like, we can only learn so much about ourselves through, I think one of the characters calls it, like, weighing herself down with the past.
Right, right. Yeah, I guess the flip side of that question is, you know, how much of a burden you feel of family history, and you're right, and how much it weighs you down and how much it informs who you are versus, you know, branching out on your own and you know, being released from it, I think is certainly one of the themes of the book.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that I feel especially indebted or burdened by either my you know, the public sphere of my family history or the more private sphere, which is certainly, I mean, there are daughters in Battleborn whose mothers have committed suicide, but I would never say that they're me, because it's not something that I've been able to approach myself, you know?
Right.
Although I'm happy to hear people making the comparison, because it tells me that those daughters felt real to them.
Right. Know? Yeah, right. Tell me about the job of the short story as opposed to the job of the novel or the memoir or the narrative nonfiction, because it strikes me that the short story is its own unique animal. For whatever reason, I don't understand it. It doesn't sell as well as novels seem to sell. But it seems like its area of concern or its what it's trying to get to is distinctly different than what novels are trying to get to. And I was curious about your thoughts on that. And whether you had ever, you know, thought to delve into novel writing, or if you're exclusively a short story writer.
Well, I started writing short stories because that's what you're taught in school, and that's how I was, like, introduced to literary fiction, was at the University of Nevada. You know, I took creative writing classes, and they gave us anthologies, and those had short stories in them. So it never really occurred to me to write a novel, although, of course, I'd read novels, but it just seems like this was a really good way to learn, and I like it a lot. I like the control you can have. Juno Diaz says that a short story can be perfect and a novel cannot, and there's something about, like, the perfectionist part of me that likes that you know, the tightness and the control and the possibility of writing something that's really perfect. I am trying to write a novel right now, which means letting go of a lot of those impulses, I think, especially because in the drafting stages, you know, I'm having to say, get comfortable saying, like, I don't really know where this is going, but let's go down the path for a little bit, you know?
Right, right.
It's been a really, I mean, of course, I have understood the differences, like, aesthetically and formally between novels and stories, you know, but it, like, starting to see my writing world as a novelist has been really tricky, because a story, you can hold it all in your brain at the same time, at least I can, you know, there's always a certain point. I mean, I'm definitely writing into mystery for a while, but there's always a certain point in which I say, yes, I know how this is going to be. And I've been working on the novel for, I mean, depending how you measure it, a couple of years now, and I haven't had a moment where I'm like, yes, I know what this is. I still don't know. And, I mean, luckily I have, like, a job and family and loved ones who will care about me, even if I'm a failure, because it still might be, it's a very, very real possibility. And with stories, I mean, the other thing is, like, of course, you can try, this is why we learn with stories, because you can try things and throw it away, and big deal, you wasted a couple weeks, maybe.
Right,
know?
Right.
And I miss them a lot.
A lot. My guest this morning is Claire Watkins. The book is Battleborn. It came out last month, a collection of short stories. I picked up the Best American Short Stories of 2011. Geraldine Brooks was the editor of that one, and she said there's, generally, in a short story, there's generally a setup, a reveal, a reversal, and a release. And, you know, she likened it to joke telling, that it has to be incredibly precise, that the characters have to be incredibly deft and well-drawn, in a few deft strokes. And that struck me as true. The other tricky thing struck me as endings. When you know when to end a short story, when you know that resonant, weird, unsettled note. And I was wondering if you could talk about that for a second.
Yeah, one of my teachers at Ohio State used to say that when you're ending a story, you just need to turn a character in the direction. We don't need to see them walk all the way down the road. Mm-hmm. And I often write endings where they're walking all the way down the road, and then I cut back. And I think there's something in the aesthetic of a really, like you said, sort of a destabilizing and yet satisfying ending of a short story, that every time I've written one myself, I haven't known it when I'm writing it. Every time I'm like, okay, I'm writing the ending now. Here's this sentence. It will be the last sentence.
Right.
It never has been. And I always go, oh, wait a second. You know, In fact, I did it today with a chapter. I was writing, and I was like, I know this chapter needs something more. And then I thought, oh, what if it doesn't? You know, wow, I actually wrote the ending yesterday, and I didn't even know it.
Yeah, right, right.
And I can't be too, feel too overdetermined. And sometimes I'll have a success where I'll write the last line of something, but I don't know why it will be the last line, and then writing to it helps with that, not feeling too orchestrated.
I always wonder if this is why the short story is a difficult sell for readers, because typically fiction readers are, I don't know, they're kind of typically women, but I've talked to a lot of women who say, I want to know the end. I don't care if it's happy or sad, but I want to know what happens. Mm-hmm. And
the short story is much more demanding on its readers. I mean, I go through this with my students too, you know, that they have the same kind of, those same needs. And I think that a story gives you that, but you have to work harder. If you really want to know what's going to happen to Lieutenant Jimmy Cross at the end of The Things They Carried, you have to read it about 24 times.
Right,
and
right.
Carefully, and which is actually pretty incredible when you think about it, because Tim O'Brien's telling 24 stories using the same exact words every time, you know? And then after you think about it for many years, then you can feel like, okay, I think I have a good handle on what's going on, but it's not going to spell it out for you. And I actually don't think readers truly want that. I mean, they say they do, but then they also express a real joy in figuring things out for themselves, you know?
Right, Right. Yeah, they become little treasure puzzles for the reader. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess the other thing of this is the symbolism in these stories and finding the right symbolism. One of the stories ended on just a brief reflection on 9/11, not an overwhelming in your face sort of reflection, but you know, finding that resonant symbol that doesn't stand in for what the story is, but reverberates or rubs against it in a different sort of texture.
Yeah.
You have some wonderful peacocks in one story. Just, you know, a lot of symbols that also make the reader work a little hard. And I'm wondering if those come to you organically or if they're very, you know, if your subconscious bubbles these symbols up or if it's intentional.
One thing that has stuck with me from when I was an undergraduate, my teacher at the University of Nevada, Christopher Koch, he would talk about internal symbols. Like, he would remind us often that human beings are symbolic thinkers. So if you have a character who is whole and well-drawn, he or she will see the world symbolically, you know? Hmm. So for me, the question that it's like a successfully imbuing your story with all the thematic depth that we expect from really great art. It has to do with like letting your characters, asking yourself, how are they going to, you know, how are they going to see this object? Of course, like you create a rich world and populate it with all this texture, objects and animals. And so in that story with the peacocks, the next step for me is to ask myself, well, how is this gay madam who's kind of coming to terms with a lot of stuff going to see these peacocks, you know? And then how will this tourist whose friend is lost in the desert, when he comes in, how's he going to see the peacocks? And if you can let your characters think of them symbolically, it will feel, like we say, more organic.
Right, right. Did these stories, did you come away from them feeling a little more settled? Did it scratch that homesickness itch? Did it reveal something to you about yourself that you didn't know, either as writer or as person? What did these stories do for you?
Wow, that's such a good question. I don't know if I've thought much about it. I think that maybe they did scratch the itch a bit, or it seems. I always really resist characterizing writing as therapeutic, right, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Kind of like the way a stockbroker might say, if his therapist said, I want you to go home and run an index on your feelings or something. Like, this is my work and my, you know,
right.
I take it really seriously. So, but at the same time, I think that there was something urgent about Battleborn. Like, I needed to be writing these stories and working on them when I was, probably did sustain me in a lot of major ways. I mean, sometimes obvious ways. I'd have my heart broken and then go write a story about heartbreak, which is typically a really terrible idea, and I have a file full of stories to prove it, throwaway stories, you know?
Right.
But, I mean, there was it's written over a major, major time of upheaval, and not just with my mom dying and being away from home, but I wasn't with my sisters. My sister had a baby, and that really broke my heart to not be able to be around my niece. I mean, it still does, honestly. And sort of dealing with anxiety and depression, and the stories, like the endeavor of writing was there with me the whole time, and it was something that was, wouldn't say that it was healing, but it was necessary.
Right.
Sure.
Do you feel do you feel done with these characters and with these places?
Not exactly. The book I'm working on right now is set in the Mojave Desert, although it's so different in every other way that I think of it still as like a major departure. I get really easily bored when I'm writing, which is one of the reasons why the stories in Battleborn are so divergent, you know, formally or aesthetically. I would just feel like, what else can I do here? Especially since the book was my education, you know, in writing, I felt like I should try an epistolary story or a future tense story or story from the perspective of someone who is much, much different than I was, right? So that like restlessness, you know, aesthetically has kind of manifested itself in writing right now a book that's about the same place, but through a totally, everything else is much different. The language, the use of language is much more lyrical and I think tighter. And so in some ways I'm done with, for now at least, the mode, but I'm still a little homesick, so still enthralled by the place.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned just a few moments ago, and I was going to ask you about this as well, that there do seem to be all of these challenges that you pose to yourself, the epistolary short story, writing from different points of view, shifting points of view in the same story, past, present, mm-hmm. You know, different time periods. And I was wondering if you almost had that set out as a framework in your head of, I'm going to give myself this challenge, or, you know, as a writing professor now and as somebody who's gone through an MFA program, here are some, you know, writing assignments or challenges that I'm going to give to myself. And I thought, what kind of a great way that is to set up a series of short stories that give you kind of a range of voice and a range of perspectives on how to write a short story.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was hoping, really. Although, on an individual level, I would just sort of, I've always been very overwhelmed by the, you know, the infinity of fiction, that you could write a story about anything, anywhere, any person, any number of people, any time period, right? There are so few rules. And that was always a little bit overwhelming for me. I found it, especially when I was really young, it was difficult to start. So I would give myself kind of these exercises, the way that like a poet might use form to organize her poetry. It was this idea of like, okay, one, it would be the place was the first set of like formal confines. It has to be set in this place. Mm-hmm. In Nevada, and then as the book went on, in specific places in Nevada. And then there would also be kind of one of these like craft experiments I would do. Some of them were a little bit more explicit, like an epistolary story with only one character in it.
Right.
Some of them were just having a book open on my desk next to me and kind of wanting to try that. You know, Ben Fountain has a story called Fantasy for 11 Fingers. I was in Best American or O. Henry a few years ago. And I really, really wanted to try to write a story like his that felt true, that felt like it was like an archive of documents and this palimpsest of different sources all piled up to create a larger story. Mm-hmm. And then adding into that was I kind of wanted to play around with a little bit of like the metafictional element, the way that Tim O'Brien does and the things they carried.
Right.
So that's how the first story came, Ghost Cowboys came, was like having these stories open on my desk. And then, so eventually if I could give myself enough exercises, I would have, hopefully something good would come out of it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. How sex screws women up seemed to be an overriding theme as well.
Oh, yeah.
All the different ways in which this will mess you up. My guest this morning is Claire Watkins. The book is Battleborn. I want to give you a chance to read to us for just a minute or two and give our readers some access, at least to just sort of the language, your voice. I always love hearing authors' voices read their own work. Can you read to us for a minute?
Of course. I'll read from the first story, which is called Ghosts, Cowboys. The day my mom checked out, Razorblade Baby moved in. At the end, I can't stop thinking about beginnings. The city of Reno, Nevada was founded in 1859 when Charles Fuller built a log toll bridge across the Truckee River and charged prospectors to haul their Comstock silver across the narrow but swift-moving current. 2 years later, Fuller sold the bridge to the ambitious Myron Lake. Lake, Swift himself, added a gristmill, kiln, and livery stable to his Silver Queen Hotel and Eating House. Not a bashful man, he named the community Lake's Crossing, had the name painted on Fuller's Bridge, bright blue as the sky. The 1860s were boom times in the western Utah Territory. Americans still had the brackish taste of Sutter's soil on their tongues, ten-year-old gold still glinting in their eyes. The curse of the Comstock lode had not yet leaked from the silver vein, not seeped into the water table. The silver itself had not yet been stripped from the mountains, and steaming water had not yet flooded the mine shafts. Henry T.P. Comstock, most opportune of the opportunists, snatcher of land, greatest claim jumper of all time, had not yet lost his love, Adelaide, his first cousin, who drowned in Lake Tahoe. He had not yet traded his share of the load for a bottle of whiskey and an old blind mare, not yet blown his brains out with a borrowed revolver near Bozeman, Montana. Boom times. Lakes Crossing grew. At statehood in 1864, the district of Lakes Crossing, Washoe County, was consolidated with Roop County. By then, Lakes Crossing was the largest city in either. The curse, excavated from the silver vein and weighted by the heavy ore, settled on the nation's newest free state.
Mm-hmm. That was Claire Watkins reading from her short story collection, Battleborn. The story is Ghosts, Cowboys. It's worth talking about titles as well, because I think titles are another trickier form for short story writers, maybe even more so than novelists or other writers, because the title carries more weight. It has to do more jobs. I love the title of the whole collection, which you can talk about maybe first, and then maybe some of the titling of the short stories themselves.
Sure, yeah. Battleborn comes from the unofficial Nevada state motto, which comes from the fact that Nevada was made a state during the Civil War, so it was born into battle. And I love the phrase, and it's really interesting, but I think most Nevadans are pretty accustomed to it. In my experience, a lot of outsiders say, oh, that's interesting, what does it mean? And then Nevadans are like, yeah, like the tattoo parlor down the road, or like all of our friends' record companies and T-shirt companies, and everything is called Battleborn in Nevada, which is fine with me. I mean, the Killers, their new album is called Battleborn, right?
Yeah.
And it's totally fine with me. I just think of it as like, the grand Nevada tradition of homage to our state.
Right.
And the other titles, a funny thing happened when I was writing this book, because it was during my MFA and I was learning to write. This happened with a lot of stuff during my MFA. I got to Ohio State feeling like I was really good at titles, like it was the one thing that I felt, I've got this down. I can title a story. I would give other people great titles for their stories. And then I lost it somehow. I just became terrible at it. So Ghosts Cowboys was one of the earlier stories, and that title just came naturally to me. Same thing with a story like Graceland, which is after the Paul Simon song.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I learned more, and I guess I, got hardened by experience and knowledge, it got more and more difficult to find good titles, because you're absolutely right, they have to bear so much weight, and they also have to look good in your table of contents, I think,
Right.
You don't want to look at a table of contents and see every single story starts with the, for example,
Right.
That just it's maybe unfair and maybe boneheaded, sure, but it suggests a really claustrophobic kind of book. So I would often list the titles I had as I was writing, I have six stories, what are they like? And, all right, I can't do any more titles with commas in them or stuff like that. And the story, the one with a really long title is called The Past Perfect, The Past Continuous, The Simple Past. And that story had probably approximately 100 titles.
That's funny, because that is one of the ones that leaps to my mind is, dang, what a perfect title.
Still, even the story was originally published in the Paris Review, and they called it Goldmine. And I thought, I like that fine, but I don't know why. You know, I can't even remember why I changed it back to what I had. But you know, one of the things that's happened with publishing a book for me is, I mean, just now when I was reading Ghost Cowboys, I'm sort of editing it in my head all the time. Like, when you're writing, you feel like you're working towards this perfect thing. But when now that I go back, I realize I could have easily have titled that story Goldmine. That's a fine title, you know? Right. Or I could have written this paragraph that I just read much differently. And so it's kind of, rather than like this perfect artifact, it's just sort of a record of where it's kind of like getting a tattoo, right? Like you're never going to, the idea that you'll find a tattoo that you're going to like for the rest of your life is ridiculous, but rather it kind of like freezes you in this moment. This is where I was when I was, in my case, 18 years old, which you can imagine, like, excellent tattoo I have.
You know? Right. Oh, sadly, we've drawn down on our time. One word on MFAs. Are you? I assume you're a recommender of MFAs for writers.
Yeah, I am, absolutely. And for all the reasons that people talk about support and community, but also I think it's important to remind ourselves that MFAs are, I think, ultimately really good for literature because they give people like me, I wouldn't have had the money or the time or the space to write a book between the ages of 23 and 26. There's like a real class privilege that has to come along with doing an endeavor like that. Yeah. And if you don't have it, the only way to get it is by an MFA program, which, of course, having more, you know, having more poor people, having more people of color, having more people from, you know, other backgrounds just makes our literature so much more vibrant and necessary. So in that way, I think that any argument against them is you know, maybe true, but not significant to outweigh all the benefits of them.
Right, right. And we find you where? You have a website.
I do, yeah. It's my name, ClaireVWatkins.com.
Excellent, excellent. And are you doing any appearances lately?
You know, I am going to be at the UC Riverside. I'm speaking at their low residency MFA program, and I'm also reading in Los Angeles on December 16th, I think it is.
Perfect.
On my website, but I'm reading at Hotel Cafe.
That is fantastic. Claire Vague Watkins, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Marie.
Thank you. The book is Battleborn. You can find Claire at her website, as she mentioned. She's got a couple of appearances, so check her out there. That's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.